No doubt you've heard of a pride of lions, a gaggle of geese, and a bevy of beauties. Maybe you have even heard of a clowder of cats, a knot of toads, and an ostentation of peacocks, and an exaltation of larks. But I know you've never heard of a revelation of plucked chickens. You couldn't have, because a revelation does not refer to a group of chickens, plucked or unplucked. And because the particular revelation I have in mind took place in my garage last Monday night. It was a minor revelation, not at all of the caliber of Moses' revelation on the mountaintop. But unlike Moses, I had not gone into the garage to speak with God. I had gone there to divest four of God's creatures of their feathers, a task I haven't had since adolescence. For those of you who are unfamiliar with chicken flicking, as it's known in the trade, it consists of dunking dirty, beheaded chickens into a bucket of scalding water, which loosens their feathers and sends a steamy cloud of foul-smelling vapor to envelop your head, steam up your glasses, and probably open up all eight sinus cavities. After the scalding, the lucky plucker can settle down to the dubious joy of pulling sticky, dirty feathers from the carcass, tweezering out the pin feathers, and lastly, chopping off its feet. Presuming that its innards have been already scooped out, you are ready to submit your victim to the ministrations of the kitchen and settle down to a delicious dinner, presuming you still have the stomach for it. I didn't. And that's when the revelation came. Not in a voice from on high, not from the midst of a burning bush, nor from golden tablets sent in from Palmyra, New York, but in the midst of the fuss and feathers of plucking chickens. The revelation began as puzzle recollection. I recalled plucking chickens in the company of my family's womenfolk years ago on the farm. I recalled that appetites were whetted, plump carcasses praised, and taste buds fairly tingled as the countrywomen of the Coots clan plucked and chopped and chatted around the steaming bucket. How come, I wondered, were their appetites so turned on, while only my stomach turned? And then it came. Because you and I have been artificially removed from the basic human work of subsistence. You and I, with our central heating, our flush toilets, and our meat and vegetables direct from the plastic-wrapped market, have been civilized into a gentility that is so squeamish that we blanch at the first sign of gore. You and I have become removed from the flesh and blood foundations of all life. That's it, you ask? That is the sum and substance of your chicken-plucking revelation? Don't scoff. Revelations are hard to come by in this church. And besides, I honestly believe that real revelations aren't especially flashy. You know, frankly, I'll bet that those stories about Moses and Jesus and Buddha and Mary Baker Eddy and the rest of the big-time revelation getters were elaborated on by what passed for press agents in those days. Truth is spectacular enough, or ought to be. It really doesn't need a chorus of heavenly hosts to be a bona fide revelation. It's only puny people of little faith who need illuminated manuscripts and mystical voices out of the whirlwinds and Hollywood pyrotechnics in order to believe. And I'll bet that if the truth were known, Jesus was working in his shop making something about as spectacular as a kitchen stool. And Buddha was actually sitting under the bow tree cleaning his fingernails. And Joseph Smith was slopping the hogs when they suddenly got the bright ideas that later turned out to be Christianity and Buddhism and Mormonism. So, don't scoff when a bright idea or an insight strikes you, however homely the setting, you may have a revelation on your hands. Anyway, there I was, suddenly aware just how far we have been removed from the source of the very food that sustains our lives. And my mind's eye began running up and down the aisles of the supermarket, looking at the waxy green peppers, the spotless carrots, the wormless cabbages, the immaculately dried beans, the conveniently filleted fish, the sweet milk without the slightest hint of barn smell, as if all had magically appeared there without any reference to the blood and sinew, bone and root, decay and ultimate death, without which we would never eat another bite. It made me realize, once again, that I am an inseparable, natural part of the interdependent food chain of this earth, and that for all my clean and tidy habits, my unmanured feet, and my bloodless hands, I am no less a predator among predators and a prey among prey than any other plant, animal, insect, or bird. It's so easy to forget the terrible wonder of such a simple fact. As long as we can keep the comfortable mask of technology in place, we can deceive ourselves about our essential nature and our place in this earthy scheme of things. We can sit by the fireplace without a thought about the body of the oak decaying so beautifully in flames in front of us. We can sit at the table without ever having to ask forgiveness for all the seeds and roots and leaves and lives that died for us that we might have life. As long as we can hire farmers and truckers and butchers and packers and plumbers and doctors and undertakers, we can pretend that we are demigods and never have to know that in some ways we have not changed since our ancestors squatted by the fire, tearing life from the bones of life. I am not suggesting anything so sophomoric as we are only brutish animals living by the law of fang and claw. No, we've come a long way from the jungle and the cave and the time when we were just one of many animals grunting and shrieking at the waterhole. But I am suggesting that we are tempted to lose touch with the earthy truth that is just as much a part of us as are the sciences and the arts, the technology and the conveniences of modern society. I think, too, not just of food, but of so many of our basic emotions and how poorly we often deal with the truly fundamental experiences and responses to living. Let me just quickly give a few examples. Take anger. The sophisticate is apt to believe that somehow he or she is above the rage, vindictiveness, and fury that more unsophisticated people are prone to. We are apt to be either amused or shocked at the newspaper accounts of lovers' quarrels in local bars. But when infidelity or jealousy or the like happens in our lives, we are often, I've discovered, at a loss as to how to handle the feelings that rise up. The fundamental human wants to rage and strike out, to assault and defend, to bellow at what he feels irrationally is threatening the borders of his territory. But the cultivated intellect represses such feelings, and people like you and me instead turn to intellectualization, which often prolongs inner suffering, and often in relationships bars forgiveness and understanding. Or consider grief. Instead of giving in to a primitive wailing that speaks to pain, or to a flood of honest tears, or to frank self-pity that cleans the guts of grief, middle-class people are more apt to think when we need instead to feel. So it is, too, with fear. The fear of night and darkness and the fear of death and all those ancient fears that have plagued our kind for centuries. We are not exempt from them. Or consider such a good thing as love. Unlike the less inhibited animals and the more emotional or less sophisticated people, you and I are even apt to love as if it were always wrapped in valentines. Or like our processed foods, antiseptically packaged on rational shelves, with no origins in the heat of our blood or in the primitive passions of our tribe. Well, I am sure that there is a place for the neat and romantic candlelighted strains of Andre Castellanos and Shakespearean sonnets. But there is also a place for sudden earthy passion, or for the laughing hug that scoops a child off her feet and swings her in the air in an impulsive celebration of delight, or for the nostalgic, tender impulse that wants to touch and kiss the aging face of a parent or a grown child. Again, don't misunderstand me. The restraint of reason is also good. Art and music, literature and decoration, education and the refinements of gentility are properly parts of our developing being. We need not become brutish anthropoids coiling over marrow bones to be either real or realistic. Nor need we envy foul-mouthed, two-fisted machos or shrill-voiced fishwives in order to keep in touch with that fundamental humanness that lies beneath our etiquette, education, and middle-class propriety. The world has a great need for our best wisdom, our highest motives, and our finest intellect. But inside us, there is also this primal being that needs recognition, direction, and outlet. We are peculiar creatures by nature. Ours are the only heads on earth that can touch the sky with abstract thought. But even when our heads are in the clouds, our feet still stand in the mud and the muck of the earth. To neglect either is to be less than fully human.